From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when a woman decided to run for public office armed with a plan to improve public transportation in her city and, yes, if it sounds a little blunt, to clean up the litter of needles and poop on city sidewalks. This is a story you might have read in the New York Times, and it does not come necessarily with a happy ending. The woman, Christine Johnson, lost her race for a seat on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, and then she and her husband decided to move out of California entirely. They are not alone. From a distance, California appears to be thriving. It's a $3 trillion economy. Unemployment is now at a record low. Some of the world's biggest companies have set up shop there. And the median household income in California, according to the New York Times, is up 17% in the past decade compared to a national average of 10%. But the Times wanted to know, why then are so many Californians unhappy? Why are so many considering a move out of state? There are many factors, of course, but this hour we'll focus on an issue that ripples far beyond the Golden State. We're talking about housing and what makes housing so expensive in some places and so affordable in others. Californians can barely afford their houses, and the Times tells the stories of so-called super commuters who spend 2 or 3 hours on daily commutes. The state is considering a new law to force cities to allow dense housing in multi-story buildings near transit stops. And next door, Oregon has all but banned new single-family house neighborhoods because lawmakers there are worried that their housing stock will become as expensive as California's. In surveys, nearly half of Californians say they might move away just because of the cost of housing. Apple, Google, and Facebook are pledging billions to build subsidized housing. Well, could a housing crisis like that happen in other places, like Western New York? What are the lessons we should draw? What pushes prices upward or downward? Our guest this hour will help us sort out the lessons here. In studio, the man who first shared this with the Rochester Urbanist Group, of which he's a part, he's also the co-founder of the Rochester Chapter of Conscious Capitalism. It's Andrew Brady. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me. Real excited for the conversation.
Yeah, and Matthew Denker is here, a developer with Labeled Living. Welcome back to you.
Good afternoon. Happy New Year.
And on the line with us is Robert Frank, an economics columnist, a Cornell professor, and the author of the forthcoming book, Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work. Dr. Frank, welcome. How are you?
I'm well, Evan, and thanks for having me on.
I got to say, Bob, Andrew Brady shared your book with me in digital form, and I told Andrew before the program began, it is one of the most profound pieces of work analyzing human behavior I think I've ever read, and I'm only 3 chapters in, so I'm looking forward to the rest of it.
Music to my ears. Thanks very much.
Well, and so listeners, we'll have Bob on separately to talk about the book, but we're going to talk about housing, human behavior, what we're learning in California, where those lessons apply elsewhere. You shared this, Andrew, and you kind of flagged a few things yourself, but what stood out in the piece to you?
You know, I think one of the things that stood out to me was that, you know, you talk about inequality and rising levels of inequality, and you start to see how rising levels of inequality, obviously they hurt the whole, but even they can start to end up hurting those at the top. You know, you start to see as inequality rises, oftentimes things happen like people start to try to do more and more to protect the wealth or the power that they have, and maybe that's putting money into lobbying, maybe that's putting money into things that aren't actually productive ends, that aren't actually leading to more well-being for them or for, you know, the city or the country.
Okay, Matthew Denker, what stood out to you?
I mean, it's just kind of shocking to see how many people are leaving. I think that's what drives the math.
Leaving California.
Leaving California. Yeah. I mean, I think some of that's what drives the math. I mean, think about this. If everyone who left California was making very little money, they couldn't afford to be there, they left, and everyone staying made a bunch of money, that alone would shift the median income massively without anyone earning an extra penny. Nobody's salary might be going up at all. Just if everyone who is at the bottom of the distribution is leaving, that's going to drive that number up.
And, you know, again, here, this is not just about California this hour, listeners, though. Many of us know people who live there, and there's always talk about the cost of housing in big cities, but that's an entire state. We're going to talk about how the lessons apply here. And Professor Frank, for you, what's the first thing that stands out from what's happening in California?
Well, reading that article that Andrew sent to you, I thought to myself, well, I wrote a column about this 20 years ago. And so I searched through my archive, and sure enough, there it was from 2001. I wrote about what I called the Aspen effect, and that's a phenomenon that you see in places like Aspen where the real estate is so expensive that the people who would need to provide services to the people who live there can't afford to live anywhere close by, and so they live 40, 50, 60 miles away, and the commute into Aspen every morning is this snarl of traffic on the surrounding roadways that stretches out for 40 or 50 miles. And we're seeing a version of that in the nation as a whole, and in particular in California, which is sort of ground zero for the inequality runaway fest that we've seen.
So I think there are so many different sort of strands that tie together here, because there is the human psychology aspect that I think I want to touch on here when it comes to why people want to live in certain places, why they put up with commutes the way they do, why they pursue the kinds of housing they're interested in, whether it's bigger houses or houses in different places, how it relates to their desire for a better life, maybe for their kids. All of that sort of tied together. But there's also the policy side. And Matt Denker warned me that he could be as dry and boring as we like when it comes to policy. I don't find it boring, by the way. I like dry and wonky policy. And some of the things that stood out to me, as I mentioned at the outset here, you've got California thinking about changing the laws to make sure that we see more denser multi-story buildings near transit sites. You got Oregon basically saying we don't want single house neighborhoods anymore. No more new single house neighborhoods. We're worried about what that means, because we don't want to be the next California. What are the policy things that stand out?
So what's really important to talk about places like Oregon or even Minneapolis, which also famously passed what could be considered a single family housing ban. It's not a ban on single family housing. It's a ban on the exclusionary zoning that says a neighborhood can only be single family housing. It's actually not stopping anyone, myself, some other developer, from building a subdivision of single family homes. It's stopping a town from saying, this piece of land is set aside exclusively for single-family homes, and there is nothing else you're allowed to do with it. So it's not forcing any neighborhood to change, and it's not even preventing the construction of new neighborhoods that are that. If there really is demand for single-family housing and someone has the money to buy those homes and a developer has the backing to build them, that's not a thing that's being stopped. But what it is doing is letting someone who, say, wants to stay in their home, would like to supplement their income, and can add an apartment above their garage, it's making it illegal for the town to say, no, you can't do that.
Okay. Does it effectively, though, as you say, it's not an outright ban on this, but did it effectively have that outcome?
I don't think so. I think there's a lot of evidence that Americans like living in single family homes, that they like having a yard and a house. I want to be careful, because, you know, just because that's what the market is providing right now, that's not necessarily what everybody wants. But it's one of the easiest things to fund. It's the least expensive construction to do.
Sure.
And so there's a lot of it, maybe more of it than we should have, but it absolutely is a thing that a lot of people clearly like. A lot of people clearly like SUVs. They're buying them. So from that perspective, I think there will continue to be single-family home neighborhoods built. I mean, if there are people with the money, like I said, and there's the ability to build them, they're not outright banned from being built, they will continue to be built.
So let me take a crack at something that's probably going to be a little bit reductive, but I am curious, as sort of a baseline, for all three of our guests to answer. If someone bumps into you at a party and they're like, Matt Denker, I love talking wonky policy, but why do you think, as a developer, California housing is so expensive? Why is it so expensive to live? And by the way, the median home price, I thought, was over $500,000 in California. I mean, it's just massive. It's more than twice the national average. From what you understand, why?
The major difference is regulations that, and the geometry of that, right? I mean, it's not particularly more expensive to build a house in California than it is in Houston. But a house in Houston is significantly less expensive, and that's because there's just more land to keep building them further and further out, and it's not a problem. In California, you can't add density in the places that need it, and you can only go so far out. I mean, there's ocean to one side, they can't go that direction, and there's mountains to the other, and you can't go that direction. And I mean, we've seen it over the past decade that damage from, say, wildfires is much higher in California, and that's because so much more housing is encroaching on that area wherein you wouldn't really want houses further that direction, that another house that direction is that much closer to the woods, to something flammable, to a place you don't want a house, and so that's the first one to burn down, too.
Okay, and so this move toward a possible changing of the laws in terms of density is probably at least a good step to at least partially deal with that?
It's certainly a start, yes.
Okay. Andrew Brady, what stands out to you when people are saying, well, would you ever move to California? Isn't it crazy to live there?
You know, I think what's funny, you know, if we go to a deeper kind of evolutionary psychology sort of perspective, is we are hardwired to look at relative fitness, right? So there's all kinds of studies. You look at behavioral economics and things, and people would rather live in a smaller house by absolute standards if it was larger than the average around them, versus living in a house that was bigger but smaller than the average, you know, in their neighborhood or whatever. And so from that evolutionary perspective, it's kind of like that relative fitness. It's like you don't have to be able to outrun the bear, you just have to be faster than your slowest friend, sort of a thing. And that's why relative fitness is so important. And so there's these bidding wars that happen, and Professor Frank can certainly talk more about this, but these bidding wars that happen where you're just trying to, you know, be above average, and by going after that, the bidding wars happen. Everyone is spending more and more on housing, but not actually getting anything different. The person who's spending the most is still, you know, in that largest house, but now they're paying way more for it because there's more people, as he was mentioning, that Aspen effect.
So this is where Professor Frank's book, I think, takes exactly the point that Andrew's making, and it takes it well beyond California and what's happening there. Because we're already seeing these kinds of effects that Andrew just talked about here in Rochester. In the last several years, we've seen housing prices in what we would, what sort of real estate agents call the hot neighborhoods, the hot towns, the hot markets, are way, way up in the last several years. And there is sort of a chasing thing happening here. And so in Professor Frank's book, and again, I'm going to sound like a fanboy for Professor Frank's book, so let me also say, having only read a handful of chapters, the rest of the book could be a bust. And if it is...
It was good. I liked it.
Oh, okay.
It.
So Andrew's going to say that. But Professor Frank, let's talk about what Andrew's discussing here, this idea of sort of relative success, either when it comes to your kids' school districts or just what your own perception of your house size. And I thought a good way to start thinking about this is the analogy you draw with someone who's going for a job interview. You want to buy an expensive or a nice suit. You want to stand out. So maybe you're willing to spend $200 on a new outfit to stand out because you want them to remember you, that you looked the part. But if everybody spends $200, well, maybe now you need to spend $500. Maybe then everybody spends $500. Maybe you should have spent $1,000 on a suit. But the problem is you're not actually gaining anything. You're just spending more, and you still look like everybody else. Can that apply in housing?
Sure. And I think an important point to bear in mind when you think about that is that there aren't really any bad actors in this narrative. You're going for your interview. You want to look good. That's the first thing the placement counselors will tell you. You want to look good. But looking good is just an inescapably relative concept. What does it mean? It means to look good relative to the other people who want the same job that you do. And so, the interviewers, they couldn't tell an hour later what color suit you wore, somebody asked them, but they somehow know whether you looked the part. And looking the part means looking good relative to the other people that they spoke with. So as you say, if everybody's spending $300 and you spend $500 or $600, you're going to stand out in some way. It's all subliminal, of course. They're not aware of this, but you're going to look good, and you're more likely to get a callback. In the housing market, there are many things people want. I think the term keeping up with the Joneses is commonly used to describe a phenomenon.
And you don't like
the one we're talking about. I don't like that expression at all. That suggests that people are insecure, that they're trying to show off or appear more wealthy than they really are. People want nice things. They would want nice things if they were living all by themselves on a desert island. What seems nice depends on what you're used to, and generally if you're used to a house of a certain size, then one that's 10% bigger than that seems nice to you. And so here's what's been happening, Evan. The rich have been experiencing most of the income gains ever since 1970, let's say. What have they been doing? The totally natural thing. They've been buying nicer things, and for them that means bigger cars, bigger houses. The people in the middle aren't angry about that. You know, they even like to see pictures of the mansions. They find that aspirational. Maybe I'll be rich someday. But there's a group just below the rich. They travel in the same social circles, and maybe now it's the custom for the people at the top to host their daughter's wedding reception in the home. They have a ballroom and an orchestra can play there. So the people just below the top, they need a ballroom too. They build bigger. And then there's a group just below them. Maybe the custom is now dinner parties for 18, not for 12. So they need a bigger dining room. They build bigger. And it cascades all the way down the income ladder. And if you don't invoke something very close to that expenditure cascade story, it's very difficult to explain why the median new house is about 50 to 70% larger than it was in 1950. Median incomes haven't been growing appreciably at all since 1970. Why is the median earner spending more? It's because people like him or her are spending more. But then why are they spending more? Because people just above them are spending more, and you follow the chain all the way through. And the reason is that people at the top are spending more. And that's not a moral failing on their part. You know, they're just doing what everybody does when they get more money. They build nicer. And you might say, well, the people in the middle, they're having to adjust in all sorts of ways, work longer hours, commute longer distances. That was one of the themes of the Time story that Andrew sent you. Why don't they just buy cheaper houses that they can afford? Well, what's true in every country, or at least every country I know about, is that the better schools are located in the more expensive neighborhoods. So if you're the median earner, and if your goal is just to send your kid to a school of average quality, you've got to spend the median price for a house in your area. If you don't do that, then it's your kids who will go to the schools that have metal detectors out front where the other students score in the 20th percentile in reading and math. And so, of course, you're going to work every margin you can to avoid that, and that's why we're seeing the kind of distress that was described in that article about California.
There is so much. I mean, this is so interesting to me because just this section of the book alone makes me think, number one, people who read it might actually make better decisions in their own lives and understand their own psychology. Do you really want this, or do you think you want this sort of for comparative purposes here? What would make you happy in a house, et cetera? I also think on the policy side, it's really interesting to kind of analyze why people are behaving as a group the way they are, and what prescriptions may work or may not work. And just looking at what has changed, let me quote from your book. You said that before Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren went into politics, she and her daughter, Amelia Warren Taiaji, co-authored a book in which they asked why most one-earner couples could live comfortably within their budgets in the 1950s, yet the two-earner couples that had become the norm by the 1990s often struggled to make ends meet. Their answer was that the second paycheck went largely to fuel a bidding war for houses in better school districts, end quote. But let me sort of extend from that, Professor Frank, and ask, does that necessarily mean that that these families were sending their kids to better schools? I mean, it sounds to me like people are just living more uncomfortably, but the outcomes are often the same.
No, that's the point. You achieve nothing. Let everyone bid the maximum amount they can for a house in the best possible school district. What's going to be true after the dust settles? Half of all kids are going to go to bottom half schools, the same as before. And that's why this is not a problem that you can solve with introspection or with a gentle nudge to urge people to behave differently. The Bush administration, the G.W. Bush administration, tried to privatize Social Security, and that proved to be a very unpopular step. But I don't think the political commentary community got the right reason for why it would have been such a bad idea to do that. When you think about saving for retirement, it's hard to do that for self-control reasons and a variety of others. But one thing we know is that if you do try to save for retirement and others around you borrow from their savings or withdraw from their savings in order to bid more aggressively for a house in a better school district, and you don't do that, then it's your kids who are going to go to the bad schools. And so if that's your choice, of course you're going to take from your savings too just to keep up. And then when the dust settles, everybody enters retirement without enough money to live on. And the only way we've made progress against a problem like that is not by urging people to save more. That's not a solution. What we did was we put on a 12.5% tax on payrolls, And we took that money and we used it to fund retirement pension checks. If we hadn't done that, there would be many tens of millions more Americans in retirement who couldn't afford to eat.
So this is where the question for all of our guests on policy come in. And I want to know, you know, sort of their thoughts on how we look at housing policy. But I before we even jump in there, Matt Denker, do you look at what's happening in California? That's the extreme example in this country right now. But do you look at what's happening in Rochester with housing prices? And do you think I'm a little worried that we're moving in certain directions?
Well, I mean, let's go with a hyper-local example of this and the schools. Yeah. I was recently kind of kicking the tires on a project at the edge of the city, basically on the city side of Norton Avenue. Norton Road, Norton Street, Norton Avenue. I think it's Norton Avenue. Anyway, I'm sorry. You know, at the very northern edge of the city.
Yes.
But if you, all of that neighborhood, both on the city side and on the Irondequoit side, was all built post-war. It's a bunch of small kind of 50s Cape Cods with a garage, usually attached, sometimes detached. And the houses look exactly the same on one side of Norton and on the other side of it. But the ones in the city all sell for under $100,000, and the ones in the Irondequoit side all sell for $140,000 and up. They're the exact same houses. They're not better maintained. They're not newer. They don't have anything different. That on average, you're paying 50% more to be on the other side of the city line. And so I don't think anywhere is immune from this, not the least of all Rochester. And I just found that to be an interesting example of bidding up to be in a different school district. I mean, that's it right there.
Yeah.
You're not getting a different house. You're not getting access to different amenities. You can walk to the same Dunkin' Donuts, you know, at the corner of Culver and Norton is on the other side of it. On the other hand, housing prices are so low here that I don't think we're in any immediate danger of suddenly running into either runaway cost increases or that suddenly broad swaths of the population that can afford housing right now will not be able to afford housing, which is not to say that there aren't a large group of people in Rochester that cannot afford housing now, and it's almost purely for income reasons, not for the cost of the housing reasons. And changing the cost of housing either up or down actually isn't really going to fix that. The housing isn't going to reach zero, and it's not going to get to California levels either, I don't think.
And part of the reason for that, Matt, is that your very most successful companies, the ones that had been contributing to growth at the high end, have struggled so much in recent decades. You know, that's a high price to pay. So it's kind of like you don't get a good outcome whether things are succeeding at full tilt as they are in California, and if they're not, you know, the only way to make this better is through some pretty bold measures in public policy.
The policy measures is kind of where I wanted to go next. Because, and listeners, if you're on the phone, Lisa, Jane will come to you in just a second. But this is where there's a really important moment, I think, in understanding, is there a role for policy? And Professor Frank addresses this directly when he writes in his book, society has a legitimate public policy interest in altering individual incentives to promote social environments that bring out the best in us. Much of what we do affects others profoundly, sometimes for good, but often for ill. Sometimes the best response will be to urge people just to mind their own business, but not always, end quote. And here's an example. I'm going to draw an example from the book and then an example from outside the book. He brings up, the professor brings up something that I had never thought about, which was hockey players would probably not wear helmets if you let them not wear helmets. And they used to not wear helmets. There used to not be rules about this. And obviously it's much more dangerous when you've got pucks flying around and fists flying around and skates flying around. But the idea of not wearing a helmet might make you see better. And it also might make you appear more intimidating. It gives you a mild advantage. So maybe a few people would do it. But then the other teams that would want that same advantage, well, they would do it. Well, now what you have is everyone in the league not wearing a helmet, which is much more dangerous. But there's nobody with the individual advantage of not wearing a helmet because nobody is doing it. So you need to set a rule that says everyone must wear a helmet. That's a case where a policy is going to address the fact that there's going to be bad outcomes here. No one's going to have an advantage. The rule makes sense.
Similar. And some people complain that the rule violates the freedom of the players, when in fact, when they're allowed to vote on whether there should be a rule like that, often they vote unanimously in favor of it.
Yeah, it's interesting.
So the concept of freedom is a lot more nuanced than some of the critics imagine.
That's okay. Where are my libertarians at? They'll hit us up. They'll let us know what they think about that. But on an example outside the book, we talk often to journalist David K. Johnston, who has written about the impact of government subsidy and picking of winners and losers when it comes to business, when it comes to seeing often big box stores getting massive incentives and advantages and coming to communities where the smaller, we might call them the mom and pops, they don't get those advantages. And often what the people who are running our governments will say is, well, if New York State didn't, or if Monroe County didn't, somebody else would. And David K. Johnston would point out, well, what you're all doing is you're all competing for the same stuff. So Amazon's still going to go where Amazon goes, and Walmart's still going to go where Walmart goes. But you're just going to get less in the way of tax revenue because you're all desperate for it. You're all playing against each other, and there's nobody with advantage because you're all playing it. So you would all have to stop. The problem is, in the hockey example, Professor Frank, I don't know how you make all the governments stop doing that. And I don't know if your book addresses that, but I am curious to know if there's like sort of a hockey helmet rule here for government subsidy, because that is out of control government spending, and it doesn't often, you know, confer much advantage.
Yeah, what you just described is often called the race to the bottom.
Yep.
And it shows up in example after example. So we see jurisdictions, states, and others competing to attract new businesses by enacting more lax environmental regulations. And so then neighboring states have to match by reducing the stringency of their own laws, and you get a race to the bottom there. Everybody gets dirty air, and the total amount of tax revenue from businesses doesn't increase one nickel. So yeah, I think it's an old debate. What's the right level to enact laws that affect, and we have a kind of a knee-jerk preference for the more local the law is, the better, it's closer to the people. But there are a lot of problems, and you just described a couple of them, that really are not best dealt with at the local level. The California housing crisis, which I think is driven in part by the zoning laws, but in large measure by the inequality that exists there, can be solved only in small measure by changes in the state tax code. They did raise their top tax rate from 9 to 13% a few years ago, and despite predictions that the wealthy would all flee in droves, the wealthy are not among the ones who that article described as leaving the state. They leave the state at a much lower rate than anyone else in the income distribution. But you can't raise the state income tax rate to 70%, which is where economists peg the necessary level in order to have a meaningful impact on the inequality that's driving the kind of changes we're seeing.
So when it comes to policy, then I'll ask our guests in studio, do policies stand out to you as within reach that would improve opportunity for housing for more people in a way that maybe would ward off what's happening in California, or make the Rochesters, the Western New Yorks, the Topeka, Kansas, everywhere in the world less likely to go through something similar? Matt Denker.
In a place like California, yes. In a place like here, no. Not from a cost perspective. We're barely clearing the replacement cost for housing here. So there's not a lot of margin on building a new house and then selling it.
Yeah.
That's kind of just what it is. If for some reason there were some large clearance, it doesn't cost $1 million to build a new house in California. It costs some couple hundred thousand, and the rest of it is regulation and land and all of those other things. Here, it costs a couple hundred thousand dollars to build a new house, and if you're lucky, you can sell it for a couple hundred thousand dollars. So I don't think we're at that point yet. That doesn't mean we shouldn't prepare for it, but also changing the policy here, I don't think is going to make a major change in the cost of new housing.
Is this a case, Andrew Brady, where you look at the broader picture of income inequality and think that so much of what we're talking about is driven by the fact that we have so much income inequality?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think one of your favorite books, you know, talking about Anand Giridharadas and the things that he's been talking about in terms of that inequality, and one of the books in the conscious capitalism movement that I recently read was called The Healing Organization. Raj Sisodia talks about, you know, a lot of the people in history that you know, Alexander the Great or other people given this great moniker often did it through great suffering. Or, you know, back to Anand's book, he talks about somebody like Andrew Carnegie, who amassed all this wealth with doing some pretty terrible things to workers and avoiding taxes and all sorts of things, but then was able to go get his name on a whole bunch of libraries and buildings and things. And I think that, you know, when you take away some of that more democratic process for how to best spend our money, and also some of just that knee-jerk anti-regulation sentiment, I think it becomes really toxic because there's all kinds of, I mean, crumbling infrastructure and all these sorts of things that in the long run, actually, I'll steal this one from Professor Frank. He talks about, you know, would you rather have drive a Lamborghini but have a potholed roads, or would you rather have a government that can have a well-maintained road and you can only afford a Porsche, right? Like being able to say, what are the kinds of things that we need to collectively do together because that's really going to be a more effective way for all of us. And again, even the people at the top will be better off.
And listeners, if you're thinking, well, it's not just about wanting bigger and bigger and bigger, shouldn't we have to worry about climate change? The book does. And on a separate day, when we bring Professor Frank into the studio, we're going to go into all of the psychology and what we've learned about our choices and, frankly, how it impacts climate as well. We got to take our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back to your phone calls. Lisa and Jane next on the phone. Listeners, if you want to join the conversation, you can call us, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections at WXXI.org. Coming up in our second hour, we run down the best new podcasts in 2020. Our panel will help us sort through what is a list of now, if you're looking at actual raw data on podcasts, nearly 1 million produced podcasts in 2019. So what are the best or the most interesting, the ones to follow? Podcasts in 2020, next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We're talking about the broader impact and the sort of the broader issues beyond California. But it was a story in the New York Times about Californians leaving that state or thinking about leaving that state, despite the fact that it's a $3 trillion economy on its own, that unemployment in California is at its lowest levels probably ever, that it's recovered, from a 30,000-foot view very well from the crisis 10 years ago. But here we are. And housing is a big part of that. Housing, commute, choices, the struggle to get by in a state that is ostensibly wealthy, but the concentration of wealth is impacting that. And we're also asking, what do we see in terms of housing policy there? How does that impact, how do those kind of policy questions impact us here? On the phone with us is Professor Robert Frank from Cornell, who's got a forthcoming book that you ought to be checking out. It's called Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work. Andrew Brady's the co-founder of the Rochester Chapter of Conscious Capitalism. Matthew Denker is a developer with Labeled Living in studio with us. Lisa in Rochester first on the phone. Go ahead, Lisa.
Hi. I appreciate that the discussion has moved more in the direction of something that I think is relevant locally, and that's, you know, income inequality and opportunities and infrastructure and our spread into the suburbs. I've been listening to stories about this upzoning issue on 1A and on many other programs, and I keep citing California as, you know, as the kind of the boogeyman, but it doesn't really relate to our community. Our community is struggling under what happened with government-supported programs, post-war, where they made sure that African Americans and Latinos and Jews could not live in certain areas because the mortgages weren't given to those people. There's actually been a nice trend of people moving back into the city. Young people are moving into the city. Empty nesters are moving into the city and reinvesting when the white middle class moved out kind of en masse post-war to the suburbs, and they just kept spreading out further and further. But this upzoning thing, as far as I know, is only being contemplated in the city, where it's not the problem, and in the suburbs, where we need more racial and ethnic diversity, it's being solidly excluded. And most of it has to do with school districts and how we fund our schools, because if, as the professor is correct, if what he says is correct, that people are going to chase better and better school opportunities, then we should fix our school opportunities, because people were very happy to live in the city of Rochester, up until just after the war, and felt their children were getting really good public school educations. But the disinvestment of people moving out to the suburbs and supporting and subsidizing infrastructure moving further and further out into our farmlands is part of what's creating our problem, and that race that race to spend unuseful capital.
Mm-hmm. Lisa, thank you for the phone call. Professor Frank, why don't you start?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point that it's not just relative quality of schooling that matters. It's also important that the schools reach an absolute quality threshold, and in many areas, they're just below it. So that's a problem that we could remedy by spending more. Once you get beyond a certain point, though, and here I'll mention the example of France, where I lived for a year, every school in France is on the same page of the national curriculum on the same day, every day of the school year. Every school has the same budget per pupil. And yet, even in France, there's a rush to get your kids into the schools that are in the neighborhoods that are more expensive. And I think the main reason for that is that everybody acknowledges that the kids who come from upper-income households get a lot more opportunities before they get to school. When they arrive in school, the learning environment in the school can accommodate a much more rapid pace, even though it's not reflected in the syllabus. And so everybody wants to send their kids to those schools, and there are just only so many schools in the top half, 50% at last count. So this is a problem that's very difficult to solve. The problem of people trying to beat one another up in hockey games doesn't get solved by helmets, but requiring helmets does at least to an extent limit the damage that they can do to one another. So I think by limiting the income gap much more than we have, we could make the cost of these moves much less serious than it's been.
Matt Denker, what do you think?
I think that I agree with the professor that you're never going to get to perfection. There's always going to be some sort of opportunities. I also think that part of the reason that people used to be okay with being in the city and in city schools was that if you look at the numbers, there was a surprising lack of diversity in a city like Rochester before the Second World War to begin with, that a given neighborhood was, say, all white anyway, and there was no reason to need to be in Brighton to be around all white people if you could be on the east side with all white people, and that sort of desire to not have any diversity pushed people to the suburbs first and then further and further out in the example that Lisa gave. I don't know how you fix that exactly. I mean, it almost has to come from policy. You can't just ask every person to be 20% less racist. I don't think that's going to get you there. So I do think it's a tough nut to crack, but we do need to start somewhere, and it probably needs to be with policy.
And Matthew Brady, Ray Ray emails to say, well, we can't fix that under capitalism. It's not compatible. And I know you disagree. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I've been digging a lot into this, and I think that when you talk about capitalism, people have a lot of different ways to define that. And when you talk about capitalism, certainly Ray Ray, I know, is really active in the community, but you can talk about a capitalism where there is more shared ownership, for example. I think ownership is so important for building generational wealth. I mean, when you're talking about historical redlining and all those sorts of things, I'm thinking back to when you had Kevin Beckford on the program, and he was talking about how I think it was the Pittsburgh town supervisor said, I don't want to social engineer anything. And Kevin said, well, we social engineered our way into this, and we're only going to social engineer our way out of it. And so we need that kind of policy. And similarly, capitalism, just like a lot of these different things, you can create that kind of arms race where, things tend to accumulate in a capitalist system, but you do need a regulation on that. I mean, we're all alive right now because we're constantly having regulation in our bodies to keep our temperature at the right level and all these different, minerals in our blood and everything. And we need that kind of regulation. And so you do need to take in a capitalist approach. You do need regulation to prevent some of those things that happen, because when the inequality rises, it becomes easier and easier to spend some of that money just to hang on to your power, just to entrench your power, whether that's through lobbying, whether that's through spending all kinds of money to, ensure that your kids get more, more wealth and things. But there are all kinds of different ways that through a more capitalist approach, you can have cooperatives, you can have different ways where you still are using a market-based model, but you have more of a shared ownership.
You want to jump back in, Matt Decker?
Yeah, I'd actually love to get Professor Frank's opinion on this. I actually think one of the only reasons housing works for generational wealth transfer at all is because we are so incredibly bad at saving money. I mean, think about what you're actually paying when you're paying your mortgage. Very little of it's going to the actual cost of the house. Most of it is interest and taxes. That's not money that you're saving. You are spending money faster than even the value of your money is increasing from inflation. You know, you've paid more than twice the cost of your house in 30 years in those things. But the house won't be worth twice as much. You know, you'll think you're ahead because you bought the house for $150,000 and it's worth $250,000 at the end of 30 years, and that's great. You've paid $300,000, and that same money is worth significantly less from inflation over that same time period. And you've spent money on hot water heaters and all kinds of other things that you need to replace over 30 years. I actually really think that the only reason housing works is because we're incredibly bad at saving money otherwise.
Professor?
We do know that if you have access to your savings, then you're going to be forced by competition to spend them in sort of arms race style pursuits. You're not irrational if you do that. That's just the best option available to you. So if you're at a concert and people in front of you stand up, you can't see, what's your best bet? You've spent $100 for your seat. Your best bet is to stand up. Pretty soon, everyone's standing up. Nobody sees any better than if everybody had remained comfortably seated. There are so many goals in life that your ability to achieve them. You mentioned the interview suit. I've mentioned a couple of times the example of bidding for better schools. There are countless other examples like that where it's not how much you spend, it's how much you spend relative to what other people spend around you that determines your likelihood of achieving the goal that you're chasing. And if you have access to your savings and it's a current goal, and the current goal is often a gateway to future goals, then rational and disciplined though you might be, you're going to have a very difficult time saving. So I think the real solution to that, I mentioned the Social Security system that keeps your hands off the money that you would have to bid for better schools, a better school district, if you weren't paying a payroll tax. That's one solution. But we could very easily start a national savings plan, one that starts every kid out with an endowment and finance it with tax revenue, and that money wouldn't be available to you anytime you wanted it. To spend on a bidding war for something, it would be available to you when you're ready to retire.
So, Matt Decker, housing sort of circumvents our tendency to spend down what we have possibly saved in a sort of an almost inevitable way, given all of the psychological pressures and factors that he's talking about.
I think so. Okay. It's the equivalent of freezing a giant credit card in a giant ice cube. That's it. It's a liquid.
Well, it doesn't really freeze it. It does put some friction in the way, but people were borrowing against their equity exactly to engage in these bidding wars. So you're right. It does make it more difficult, but it's not a perfect freeze.
And before I turn to Jane's phone call, let me also just put a more serious point about this. Matt asked before the program if we had read Richard Rothstein's book, The Color of Law, which we did. We had him on the program and should probably be required reading in every school and in every household in the country. And when we talk about housing being a way to build wealth because of all of these other pressures that the professor is talking about in his book, it's a reminder of just how devastating it was to deprive people of the ability to accumulate generational wealth via housing, as this country has done, primarily targeting families of color and depriving them for decades. I mean, that is a massive, massive legacy that we are dealing with.
And if you read it, it's so much worse than that, unfortunately.
Yeah,
all we did was say, you can't buy a house, and that was it, that would have been fine. But all of the schemes that cropped up to actually steal the wealth, too, contract housing, things like that, are it swings even further in the other direction.
Yeah, it's a book everyone should read. All right, let me get back to the phones, and we got to try to squeeze in a lot here in the last 8 minutes. Jane in Rochester. Hi, Jane.
Yes, you're former caller. Stole my thunder on a lot of things, because I hear people talk about better schools, and I think that was a good comment about why not improve all schools. But sometimes I feel like people say that we want the better schools, and it's just code for white schools or schools, it's just code for bigotry of some sort or another, even if it's just class. But if they're overpriced, it seems like, if the homes are overpriced, it seems like what's, they're trying to buy status and maybe some conspicuous consumption, and that's their right to do. But I'm a little skeptical about some people when they say better schools. It just sounds like the old dressing up of other motivations with people. Thank you very much.
Okay, Jane, thank you very much. Professor, you want to hit that?
Yeah, I think there are undoubtedly people who, when they think good school, they think a school that's attended only by people like me. But the problem isn't limited to that. You know, we've seen a version of this same problem crop up in bidding wars in areas that are actually quite diverse. So that's a dimension of the problem, but it's not anything like the entire problem.
Okay. Jane, thank you as always for the phone call. Let me read an email from Paul. I think there's some great points here. Paul says, whatever happened to the not-so-big house movement when people realized that bigger didn't necessarily mean better, a lot of space to have to fill, and many rooms that had only one part-time use? It was in the details that people found delight and satisfaction. I see so many tract homes, rental and ownership, that look so bland and cookie-cutter. Potential clients come to me with copies of these books, bookmarking things they would like to see in their home and remodel. How can young people saddled with massive college afford these larger and larger homes, especially when they often have to pay massive childcare costs as they start their families? So, first of all, Paul, it's a great question. And Professor Frank, there is a lot of research on happiness and satisfaction and buying a bigger and bigger house. In other words, if your house is 3,000 square feet and you get a house that's 4,000 square feet, do not expect to be rolling in happiness. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, there's a huge literature that's tried to determine what things in life actually make a difference in terms of how happy people feel and the moods they report at various times when they're surveyed. And there's endless debate about what matters in that literature. But if you could say there's one clear finding in it, it's that beyond a certain point, bigger doesn't seem to make any meaningful contribution to happiness if everybody in the group gets bigger. So if all the mansions were already 10,000 square feet, I think we could say with very high confidence, waving a magic wand that would make them all 11,000 square feet wouldn't make anybody one bit happier. In fact, I would be willing to bet my entire retirement savings that it would make everybody less happy just because it would be more nuisance to manage the bigger properties. All you need is to have a house that seems okay. I was in the Peace Corps in Nepal for 2 years. I lived in a two-room house that didn't have any electricity or plumbing. Not for one minute did that house ever seem unsatisfactory to me. I was happy to invite guests there. If I lived in that same house in Rochester or Ithaca, I would be embarrassed for people to know where I lived. It would be a signal that I had failed miserably in life. So it's all about context, really. And I think we have a really powerful interest in not allowing the context to run away with us, as it will if we don't do anything.
Yeah, so let me ask our guests in the studio, what do we do with that, knowing that if you had two situations, as the professor writes about in his book, in which if the average house was 1,500 square feet and someone was given a choice to have a 2,000 square foot house, would they choose that? Or would they choose a 3,000 square foot house, but then the average house was 4,000 square feet? They would most likely choose the 2,000 square foot house just so they could lord it over everybody else. And I think that's probably actually good when it comes to climate change, so this might not be the best example. But the bottom line is the psychology is fascinating. What do we do with that, Andrew Brady?
I think part of it is a cultural phenomenon. It's what do you celebrate? Because you're gonna get more of what you celebrate. Plato said, "What gets honored in a country gets cultivated there." So part of it is there does need to be a bit of a cultural change in terms of what we do celebrate. But I as much as I'm optimistic about those sorts of things, one of the things that I think is interesting back to, you know, that point of relative fitness is, you know, because maybe you used to be just looking at your immediate neighborhood and I want to, you know, have a bigger house in my immediate neighborhood or something along those lines. Now with things like social media, like what is local when you're at all the pictures that you take, you know, whether it's from a wedding or your house or anything like that, you're seeing so much more of, you know, trying to either one up or just keep up. And so I think that becomes a even more of a challenge.
1 minute left to solve all of this. As a developer, how do you view this question?
Well, so I actually think this is one of the places that's even harder still to fix, because it's not just the psychology of buying the house, but from the market side of it, providing that house. If we took all the houses that were 2,000 square feet and said, all right, we'll build them 1,500 square feet instead, they would cost only nominally less, not 25% less, because a house is a bathroom and a kitchen and heating and cooling, and that costs something no matter how much square footage is around it. And those marginal square feet going from 3,000 to 4,000 square foot houses, that last 1,000 square feet, assuming it's not a third kitchen or a second kitchen or something, costs next to nothing. So it's actually the kind of thing that, as a developer, you could throw that extra square footage in, and even though the house will cost more overall, say on a per square foot basis, it actually gets cheaper and cheaper the larger it gets without adding other mechanicals. So I think this is a really, really tough problem to solve, because it's not just the desire to look better than everyone else. It's being pushed easily from the market.
All
side.
You did in the last minute was frame the problem. You didn't solve it.
I'm so sorry.
I didn't ask you to come here.
Policy is the solution.
I want to thank our guests. This has been a remarkable conversation, and frankly, there's a lot more that goes with this, so we will keep coming back. And Professor Frank, I hope we can talk to you soon about the book at large. Will we do? Can you do that?
I would be delighted to do that. Just ask me.
That is wonderful. You've been asked. Robert Frank, an economics columnist, Cornell professor, and author of the book Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work. Andrew Brady, co-founder of Conscious Capitalism in Rochester. Thank you, sir.
Thanks for having us. And if you'd like to hear Professor Frank, he will be in on the 11th. He'll be in Rochester with the Cornell Club of Rochester, cornellclubrochester.org.
cornellclubrochester.org. He's wearing his Cornell sweater. Matt, you're just wearing a brown shirt. Nice to see you.
Thank you. Nice to see you, too.
Matt Danker with Labeled Living. More coming up.